Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is March 21, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is joining us for an episode involving Goebbels, Communism with the Mask Off, another Goebbels speech. How are you doing today, Bill?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. And before we begin with Goebbels discussing communism, this is before the war, correct? This is a speech prior to the outbreak of war.
The speech was delivered in Nuremberg on September 13, 1935, at the 7th National Socialist Party Congress.
All right, I just wanted to read one Goebbels quote, the Iron Curtain quote, which he read right before the war ended. And in 1945, I believe, Goebbels said, If the German people lay down their weapons, the Soviets, according to the agreement between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, would occupy all of East and Southeast Europe, along with the greater part of the Reich. An Iron Curtain would fall over this enormous territory controlled by the Soviet Union, behind which nations would be slaughtered. So they understood perfectly the track record of communists and Bolsheviks. They knew what would happen. Anywhere communists take over, heads are going to roll.
Absolutely.
Isn't that what always happens? You said that when the Jews are in power, heads roll.
When the Jews are in power, the heads roll. And that's the French Revolution is proof of that. That's the first country the Jews got any large degree of power over in Europe, and the heads rolled as soon as they got power.
And they created a state-run atheist church, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They banned Christianity. Robespierre banned Christianity and created his own religion.
Sounds like Ben Klassen.
Yeah, well, that sounds like Zechariah Sitchin, Ben Klassen. Who's that Scientology clown, L. Ron Hubbard? I mean, there's no end to these people.
And half of them are Jews, and the other half are paid off by Jews.
Yes, it appears to be that way. I wouldn't argue with you.
All right.
I'd like to read the introductory notes to this speech.
Certainly.
And start off with that. And that's because I think they're pretty good.
And, all right.
First, let me say that I have two copies of this speech, and both copies are the same translation. The first copy is found at Calvin University at the German Propaganda Archive, which is really a pretty good source, and I just downloaded the whole thing the other day, and just so I could sort through it without having to go through the links online. And the staff member at Calvin University who put the German Propaganda Archive up, he claims that this is not a – And the quality of the translation is not the best. The spelling is British, and the quality of the translation is not the best. But he doesn't offer a better translation, which is, it's just ad hominem criticism. It has no place if you're not going to actually cite why the translation is not good. But I'll be reading from the Liberty Bell Publications copy of the speech. And I have a facsimile of this posted on my Mein Kampf site, and I have the Calvin text posted on a Mein Kampf site in text form. And I'd like to read the translator's notes. In the following pages, there are some passing references which call for a brief introductory comment. In pre-war days, Russia was often spoken, and that means pre-World War I, Russia was often spoken as the granary of Europe. Dr. Goebbels says that if it were under proper administration, it could still supply grain for the whole of Europe. Yet he states that under the Bolshevik regime, millions are dying of hunger year after year in this vast granary. Is this a fact? They're asking, is this a fact?
Well, this seems comparable to what happened with Rhodesia to Zimbabwe, that Rhodesia supplied much of Central Africa with food, and now, as Zimbabwe, run by blacks, not just any blacks, but communist blacks under Mugabe, they have a famine crisis, and they have to receive UN food shipments.
Well, absolutely. Communism produces nothing. So they're asking, basically, in this introduction, is this a fact? And if it be a fact, what is the explanation? He gives the explanation clearly enough. If we admit the fact, we shall not find it easy to refute his reasoning. And the facts are proven and will be proven, and we have proven them here. In referring to his authorities for the statement of fact, he was rather cursory, as was necessary within the specified time allowed for his speech. He merely states that the truth of this awful spectacle of what may be called perennial famine can be proved from reliable documentary sources, among which are even the official reports of the Soviet authorities themselves. But the most striking testimony of all are the pronouncements of such public personalities as the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Cardinal Archbishop of Vienna. As Dr. Goebbels has merely referred to their statements, I have thought it well to repeat these statements here in their original form so that the mind of the reader may be fully satisfied as to the sources of information which Dr. Goebbels uses in his indictment of the Bolshevik regime. On January 26, 1934, the Times published the following report of a debate in the House of Lords. Quote, "The Archbishop of Canterbury said that he was sometimes surprised to notice that some of those commonly associated with Lord Ponsonby, while most eager to defend workers and peasants in this country who were alleged to be exploited by capitalism, seemed extraordinarily averse to consider the case of peasants and workers in Russia who were exploited by a powerful capitalist bureaucracy. They seemed always to resent any attempt to lift the veil carefully placed over foreign observers by the Soviet government and to realize and face the appalling misery which in vast areas of Russia lay behind that veil. After a long and full study of an immense mass of documents and evidence from all quarters and the examination in many cases of sufferers themselves, the impression left on his mind was that the condition of things last year in Russia, and particularly in parts of southern Russia, was appalling. The number who died of hunger was nearer 6 million than 3 million.
So
in one town, 40,000 out of a population of 240,000 died. In another, 40% died out of 40,000 inhabitants. There were places where people were living on cats and dogs and where horse flesh was a luxury. There were places where the advent of mice in spring was regarded as a providential source of food." I'm sorry, go on.
I'm going to say that when firsthand accounts are given by survivors from Bolshevik terror, they're basically ridiculed and laughed at, and they're referred to as conspiracy theorists, liars, kooks, right-wing extremists. Yet when a Jew claims that he saw a lampshade made out of human skin, they make a movie out of it.
Well, right, and that's what the Jews do. They lie. they lie in their favor, and they lie in to their advantage whenever they can.
We'll never see a movie about the Red Terror perpetrated by the Cheka.
Absolutely not. Not until the Jews are thrown out of power anyway.
Although I did see a movie. I have it on my computer with subtitles. It's in Polish. It's about the Katyn massacre. It came out of Poland just about a year or two ago, and it actually shows the Bolshevik commissars, ugly-looking Jews, shooting Polish officers in the back of the head.
There's no doubt. There's been plenty of that.
We'll never see something like that coming out of Hollywood or Western media.
It'll never happen. Not as long as the Jews are in control.
And in fact, the Jews are basically denouncing the movie, and the Russian government is denouncing the movie. They're saying that it's anti-Russian, anti-Semitic propaganda, blah, blah, blah. And the official Russian version of the events is that the Germans and the Nazis massacred all those Polish prisoners.
And that's actually been proven since Glasnost. In the 90s, it was proven that the...
Gorbachev admitted it. He declassified the documents and admitted about the massacre.
Right.
And the international...
well, that was all part of Glasnost, and they hated him for it.
Mm-hmm. And the International Red Cross investigated the site of the massacre, and they concluded that it had to have happened when the Soviets controlled the zone, not when the Germans came through.
You know, the Red Cross is being blamed for suppressing the Holocaust. The Red Cross was all over Germany during the Second World War, and there was never one report that there was a Holocaust.
How interesting.
In fact, all the Red Cross reports that we can get our hands on show prove just the opposite. Let me read the last paragraph of this Archbishop of Canterbury's report, speaking about his witnesses for these atrocities in Russia and all of these people dying of hunger. And he's talking like close to 6 million people just at this time. He had photographs, the authenticity of which it was impossible to doubt, of corpses lying in the streets and other bodies simply waiting on the pavements for death while the people of the town were passing by as if there was almost nothing particular to notice. He hoped that some of these appalling events belonged to the past, but there could not be but apprehensions about the future. And there's one more testimonial to support Goebbels' speech offered by this writer. The Earl of Denby said that he had heard a great deal lately in the way of particulars of the appalling conditions in Ukraine, where the largest portion of the Catholic population of Russia was found. They had heard of the treatment of the bishops and the clergy in the Ukraine, and he had seen photographs of the appalling state of affairs in the streets and in the country generally. It must be remembered that all this had been brought about by the deliberate policy, the bloodthirsty and callous system, which had been practiced in Russia for the purpose of forcing the population into the doctrines of communism. On December 16th and 17th, 1933, a meeting was held in the Archbishop's Palace at Vienna, presided over by His Eminence the Cardinal Archbishop of Vienna, Dr. Theodor Initzer. This meeting was attended by representatives of all the international and interdenominational relief associations organized for the help of the starving people of Russia. The conference issued the unanimous statement that millions of innocent people in the Soviet Union were in the grip of famine and that the relatively good harvest of 1933 would be able to bring only transitory alleviation. And that's not as strong as I would like it to be. There's two more paragraphs.
Question. They started a relief agency to help the Soviet Union.
Yes, they did.
Now, how much of this aid actually wound up in the hands of the Russian peasants?
Well, how much of our food aid actually ends up in the hands of the Negroes laying on the fields of Zimbabwe?
They're still laying there.
Of course it is still laying there. And the local chieftains took that food aid and probably sold it to the Rhodesians or sold it on the markets in India or China or wherever they could get rid of it.
Well, to me, that these Jews create the problems and then they lead the foundations that are dedicated to solving the problems. The same thing with human trafficking, all of these women being trafficked into slavery. I look at some Jew feminist leader.
They're the masters of organized crime.
Mm-hmm. But they're leading the groups that are tasked with solving these problems, and they're given public funding to solve these problems, yet nothing ever happens because, you know, one Jew isn't going to go after his Jewish cousin who's trafficking shiksas, goyim women, into slavery. He's basically just going to pocket the money and probably go buy a few himself.
And we have an entire Jewish-run media here in the United States that's absolutely ignoring the tens of thousands of Ukrainian women and Russian women who were taken and other Eastern European women who were kidnapped into sex slavery in Tel Aviv.
And I've pointed out that if there were 10,000 Jewish women, I don't know why they would want Jewish women, but imagine if there were 10,000 Jewish women forced to work in brothels in Syria and held as sex slaves. The American Marine Corps, the Army, everybody, we'd be hitting the beaches of Syria, paratroopers would be jumping in, and the entire UN would be passing resolutions condemning Syria, calling for war. All of NATO would be mobilized, and there would be war within 10 minutes, and we'd be seeing documentaries about how these women suffered. There would be dramas, book offerings, and we'd be hearing, remember the 10,000, oy vey, they suffered so much.
And it would all be for nothing anyway, because the place would be out of business by itself in 3 months. I mean, nobody would spend a dime there. Nobody would spend a dime there.
Exactly. Okay. Is there such a thing as a Jewish prostitute?
Yeah, they're called Judeo-Christians. The same committee issued a further proclamation on July 12, 1934, under the presidency of Cardinal Initzer. The proclamation stated, there is no doubt that in the Soviet Union, a new famine wave of unpredictable extent is about to break in. Millions and millions are again threatened with famine. Again, countless people must succumb to the distress unless a brotherly helping hand is reached to help them from the outside. To prove that the famine of the above spoken of in the above pronouncements is of a recurrent nature and is not to be explained by the drought of 1933, when is only to cite still more urgent appeal issued from the same quarter on February 5, 1935, signed by Cardinal Innitzer and, among others, by the Jewish Rabbi of Vienna. The text of this appeal ran thus: relief for the famine areas in Soviet Russia, an appeal by the Interdenominational and International Relief Committee. The undersigned relief organizations, which include the various churches and denominations in their work for the starving people of the Soviet Union, deem it their duty to make the following public announcement. It is our firm conviction, which cannot be shaken by any reports to the contrary, that large sections of the Russian people are facing a new climax in the terrible famine disaster. Now remember, this Russia used to feed the entire continent of Europe with grain.
And now they can't feed themselves.
No. An immense mass of direct information and the indubitable testimony of eyewitnesses during the last 2 years established the fact that the greatest distress exists among the population in certain areas of the Soviet Union and among certain classes of the Russian people. Today, even the Russian official announcements acknowledge that large numbers of people in the afflicted areas are entirely without provisions and are irrevocably given over to famine.
We addressed that in Russia number one, why that was, because certain people were in categories where they were only given, one-eighth of a pound of bread a day, and that's because they were fortunate enough to have a small amount of land and employ one or two people, and they were classed as bourgeois.
Well, right, but they actually they deprived all the farmers of all the grain. I mean, the farmers wouldn't want to plant anything if you can't keep the fruits of your labor or do with them what you please. If you're not rewarded for the fruits of your labor, you're not going to have any labor.
Well, they were being worked so hard, they weren't making enough to justify working. They were probably spending more calories working than they were even able to afford. They're required to work 12 hours a day, and they only get to keep 1 hour's worth of wages. And that doesn't even cover the expenses associated with working.
Well, let's see why the Jews hate farmers. I have to go to Genesis chapter 3. This is pretty much off the cuff, and I had just I had thought about the idea before. Don't worry, but Jews hate farmers. This is why Satan hates farmers. And this is Yahweh talking to Adam, Genesis 3:19. In the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread, till thou return to the ground. For out of it was thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. Adam was placed in the garden to farm and tend and keep the garden.
And the Talmud declares that agriculture is the lowest of all occupations.
Well, absolutely. And why? Because where you find a farmer, you're almost surely to find an Adamite. I mean... The non-Adamic races, they don't really farm like we do.
Well, the blacks complain they want 40 acres and a mule. What would they do with it? They'd probably sell the mule for drinking money, and within a year they'd be thrown off their land because they'd have debt.
No doubt. Well, basically the Jews hate farmers.
Have you ever encountered a Jewish farmer?
And Adam was put in the garden. Why? To tend the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Adam is basically the world's first farmer.
Absolutely. Well, I talked to some Jews, and they try and claim that there's kibbutzes in Israel and that Jews farm, blah, blah, blah. No, they are managers of kibbutzes. The actual working of the ground, that's done by Arabs.
Right, it's done by Arabs, or it's done by stupid American kids that think it's cool to go over and work on a kibbutz, and stupid European kids that think it's cool to go over and work on a kibbutz for a
year. They last about 2 or 3 weeks, figure, wow, this is hard, and then they go back to Tel Aviv, Haifa, or Brooklyn. There's no such thing as a Jewish farmer.
Well, to go on with this presentation, today even the Russian official announcements acknowledge that large numbers of people in the afflicted areas are entirely without provisions, and this is important, and are irrevocably given over to famine. That pretty much means that they're going to die. According to the report of an American eyewitness, the harvest has been collected with unprecedented severity. In other words, the government is ripping the harvest out of the farmers' hands. And only thus was it possible to abolish bread cards in the cities. The harvest produce is distributed, first of all, in favor of the army. the industrial population, and other privileged groups in the cities, whereas the lives of the people in the agricultural districts, and especially those of the individual farmers, are once again placed in grave danger. A decree published by the Soviet government on the 26th of December 1934 proves how serious is the distress. That's the presentation. That's the introduction to this speech. And basically what it's doing is it's corroborating everything that Goebbels is saying in the speech.
And this basically reinforces Russia number one. It seems to me that Goebbels read Russia number one.
Well, they certainly had the same reports, I'm sure.
He was basically reading the newspapers every day that confirmed what Russia number one states. And instead of having to read it as we read it 80 years after the fact, he lived it.
Well, right. And to see that the Germans were aware of everything going on in the Soviet Union, it is to understand the German fear of Bolshevism and the rise of Adolf Hitler, the only politician who stood against it.
Yet the Americans were seemingly unaware.
All the other German politicians were absolutely vacillating. The American people were unaware. The American leaders sure weren't.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you have to remember that most of our major media was controlled by the Rothschilds and the Jews, even at that time.
Mm-hmm. You said that the Jews grabbed up the New York Times in what, the 1880s or 1890s?
The Jews, I think, bought the New York Times in 1895, and Jews bought the Washington Post at a fire sale, basically, in a bankruptcy auction in 1933, and they turned them into the two most prominent papers in the country. And then you had the Los Angeles Times was in the hands of a non-Jewish family, and I know their name, but Peyton, I think, or where is that the Oscars held at a certain pavilion in L.A.? That's their.
Oh, name. I have no idea.
Yeah, I know. I can't remember it. I'm embarrassed now. I should. The only paper that was a good the only major newspaper that was a solid anti-Jewish paper was basically the Chicago Tribune for a long time and Colonel McCormick.
I'm reading here that they named a pavilion in the Los Angeles Music Center.
The Chandler Pavilion.
Yeah,
the
Dorothy Chandler.
Right, the Chandlers, I don't think they were Jews, and they controlled the Los Angeles Times for a long time.
Now, Hearst was a Jew, right?
I don't know if Hearst was a Jew, but Pulitzer was a Jew.
Oh, absolutely.
And very influential. If Hearst was not a Jew, he missed a good opportunity.
Yellow journalism
is definitely Jewish in nature.
Wikipedia admits that that Pulitzer was a Jew. They list him as a Jew. They claim him as one of their own.
Well, a great section of our media, and the most influential media, was in the hands of the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes CBS, which was founded by a Jew. Bill Paley, William Polinski. He's a Jew. He's a Polish Jew. And he founded CBS. There's all sorts of evidence of Jewish control of most of the early media in this country. Not all of it, but a great portion of it. And the most influential, the New York Times, the Washington Post, that they were the most influential. And I'm sure they were most influential because of the way they were bankrolled and the people behind them.
Most people at this time got their information from newspaper. Radio wasn't that big since not everyone had a radio. Am I correct at this point in the 30s in America?
Well, in the 30s, I think radio had gotten pretty big, and just about everybody did have a radio, especially by the end of the 30s.
So probably it would be radio and newspaper, not necessarily the newsreels, though, since most people didn't have access to a movie theater, did they?
Well, I know when my mother was a child and my father was a kid, that they made a big thing out of going to the movies once a week.
Mm.
My mother talks all the time about how every week she got to go to the movies and it cost her a whole quarter for popcorn, the ticket to get in, and a soda.
Well, even in the 50s when my grandparents would go to the movies, it was over a 100-mile venture. They would have to go from the Ohio-Pennsylvania border where they lived into Cleveland. So not everyone had access to a movie theater. I would assume that your mother and grandmother lived in a more urban area?
Well, no, they lived in a rural southeastern Massachusetts, small town southeastern Massachusetts. But the East Coast is a little different than the center of the country. Ohio is more Midwest than it is East Coast, you know?
Mm-hmm. But the
in
point
fact,
is
that's why Northwestern University's in Ohio, isn't it?
The Jews pretty much own all the media, even at this point, lock, stock, and barrel, aside from one or two publications.
Well, it's the major media is basically being controlled by the Jews in the 30s, yes.
Mm.
Hollywood is controlled by the Jews in the 30s. There's no doubt. The Warner Brothers, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, they were all Jewish controlled.
So we're never going to see a newsreel with an accurate, fair translation of a Goebbels speech or a Hitler speech.
Well, you know, all of the news between Europe and North America at that time was controlled by Reuters.
Mm-hmm.
They had a virtual monopoly on news between Europe and the States.
Well, I heard when World War I erupted that Britain cut the cables from Germany to the U.S., so Germany could not communicate with the U.S. at all in World War I.
Well, I mean, that's probably a good move on Britain's part. I mean, strategically, but you want to start reading this?
All right. Communism with the Mask Off by Dr. Joseph Goebbels. Speech delivered in Nuremberg on September 13, 1935 at the 7th National Socialist Party Congress. In the beginning of August this year, one of the most authoritative English newspapers published a leading article entitled Two Dictatorships, in which a naive and misdirected attempt was made to place before the readers of the paper certain alleged similarities between Russian Bolshevism and German National Socialism. This article gave rise to an extraordinary amount of heated discussion in international centers, which was only another proof of the fact that an astonishing misconception exists among the most prominent Western European circles as to the danger which communism presents to the life of the individual and of the nation. Such people still cling to their opinion in face of the terrible and devastating experiences of the past 18 years in Russia. The author of the article stated that the two symbols which are today opposed to one another, namely that of Bolshevism and National Socialism, stand for regimes which, quote, in essential structure are similar, and in many of their laws, their buttresses are identical. The similarity is moreover increasing. He went on to say, quote, in both countries are the same censorship on art, literature, and of course the press, the same war on the intelligentsia, the attack on religion, and the massed display of arms, whether in the Red Square or the Tempelhofer Feld, end quote. I'd like to point out as an aside here, I saw some poster on Stormfront, a longtime poster, trying to contend that National Socialism is fundamentally communist, revolutionary, it's against big business, it's against private property, and that it's for feminism and the liberation of women. And he was going on and on talking about how we need to secularize the world and destroy religion and blah, blah, blah. And if I were there, I would have just called the guy a Jew.
Well, yeah, he may as well be a Jew. And National Socialism is not against big business and private property. National Socialism is against parasitic capitalism.
Mm-hmm. And that's a
okay.
Jewish venture.
Capitalism raids a country of its wealth and transfers it. And we see that here. I mean, where was the microchip discovered and invented? In the U.S., how about all of our machine tools? Where are our machine tools?
They're in
China,
Brazil.
Where is our entire manufacturing capability? Our entire manufacturing capability is now in China. How much of this was invented in China? None of it.
Well,
the Jews, international capitalism, took our entire intellectual legacy and technological legacy and transferred it to another race of people. And capitalism let that happen. Now, fascism, by the contrary, is a response to capitalism. Fascism tells the capitalist that you can invest your money in an endeavor, and you can build your product and sell it to the people, and you can make a profit on it. However, the intellectual material belongs to the society, and you are not going to give it away, and you are going to build products that are beneficial and needed by the society. In other words, you could invest your capital and make your money, but we're going to make sure that you're benefiting the people and the community that are supporting you.
And if they want to open up a factory in China, they're not going to take money from the community and finance a venture overseas to give jobs to Chinamen.
Well, absolutely not.
And that's why fascism is a much better, I'm not saying it's perfect. I wrote an article, it's on the blog at Chris Degenia, about fascism versus capitalism. Fascism is a much better, a much more sound system for the Christian community because it protects the community from the ravages of the vultures, of the capitalist vultures. And fascism arose in Europe in the 1920s as a reaction to the evils of Jewish capitalism.
Absolutely. And just before this program began, my dad and I were watching a history show, and it had Churchill, Roosevelt on there. Roosevelt was shouting about the arsenal of democracy, and they were talking about America's industrial base. And I said, if you notice, once we were done making the world safe for the Jews so the Jew could take over everything with the UN, we no longer had to be the arsenal of anything. So all of our industry was shipped off to China over the next 30 years. And I said, so the greatest generation went to war, made the world safe for the Jew, and then they sat back while their schools were integrated. Their daughters were taught to go with blacks. Their grandchildren are blacks now. And all the factories that they worked at and their grandfathers and fathers worked at, those were shipped off, and their sons are left to figure out what to do. Go work at McDonald's.
Well, basically, they've looted and pillaged this country of all. And it's adversely affecting our economy. They're making us into Mexico is exactly what they're doing.
They want us to be landless serfs.
Yes. They will own everything, and they're making us into Mexico. And the average white man, no matter how what his skills are, or no matter what his education level or his abilities, will be making $10 to $12 an hour. That's the Jewish capitalist dream.
And that'll be taxed to such an extent that he won't be able to afford to have a family because he has to pay for six illegal aliens who are living just down the road.
Well, capitalism is the slow route to Bolshevism. There's no doubt.
But the end result is the same, the destruction of the white race.
Absolutely.
All right.
And Adolf Hitler understood it. It's all through Mein Kampf. All throughout Mein Kampf, he talks about the marriage between communism, Marxism, and how it's just a tool of international capitalism.
All right, continuing. Quote, "The strange and terrible thing is," he declared, "that two nations, once so widely different, should have been schooled and driven into patterns so drably similar," end quote. One sees here much verbiage and little understanding. The anonymous writer of this article has obviously not studied the essential and fundamental principles either of National Socialism or Bolshevism. He considers merely certain superficial phenomena, and he has not taken cognizance of what serious journalists here had to say on the matter in question or compared his views with their objective statements. This entirely erroneous judgment of the case might be passed over with a shrug of the shoulders and considered merely as part of the daily order of things, were it not for the fact that the two problems here discussed belong in their essentials to political phenomena which are all important for the future of Europe. Moreover, this strikingly cursory judgment on the problem is not merely a single case, but has to be taken in conjunction with a much wider and more influential section of Western European opinion. And I have seen some communists make the argument, in fact, many communists, that fascism is the last gasp of a dying capitalist regime, that when capitalism is on the way out, they have to revert to imperialism and fascism to prop up the system. And that makes absolutely no sense. That's a typically Jewish propagandist understanding of fascism, since fascism, as you said, is a reaction. It's basically a populist uprising against capitalism. Fascism.
Exactly.
Fascism is an anti-communist revolutionary movement that is also anti-capitalist. It is not a movement to shore up capitalism. It's a movement to end capitalism.
Exactly, because capitalism is evil. I mean, Bolshevism and communism are evil. It's stealing. But capitalism is evil, too. We have been trained from youth, from childhood, to believe that capitalism is the answer to communism, and that is a lie. Capitalism, the way it's practiced in the West today, is evil. When you give one family or one company or one person the right to counterfeit money, and as soon as that money is created, and that's the only way that money could get into the society, and that's what we have here in the Federal Reserve, and that's what we have in the Bank of England and every other central bank, in their respective countries, those banks have the right to counterfeit money to create fiat money from nothing. Okay? And when you give one person the right to counterfeit money, and he's the only one that can create money, the inevitable result is that that person ends up with all of the wealth of the nation. There is no avoiding it.
Well, wasn't it Meyer Amschel Rothschild who said, give me the power to print the nation's currency, and I care not who makes the laws.
And they knew what they were doing. The Jews knew what they were doing.
These leftist sites that I tend to frequent leftist sites just to read and see what they have to say. It's never anything of any intellectual value. They honestly believe, or at least they articulate the belief, that fascism stems from capitalism and that the U.S. is a fascist country because we have big companies and we're run by big companies and they're exploiting all the third world poor peasants. They seem to believe that fascism favors the exportation of jobs. If Mussolini were running this country, he would have most of the CEOs shot or thrown in prison for what they're doing to the workers, wouldn't he?
He probably would. When you lay off your workforce, and basically they're destroying their own customers, and move all of your labor operations overseas, and import the goods into the country, what are you doing? One manufacturing job in a community probably supports, I mean, I never did the whole economic study on it, but I would believe it probably supports 3 to 4 service jobs.
Absolutely. Well, the thing is, in my grandmother's town, they used to have a big railroad and a big shipping docking industry, and they had almost 20,000 people in the town. Probably 10,000 worked at one of those two places, either the railroad or the docks. The docks basically closed, the railroad's gone, and now the population's about 11,000 20 or 30 years later.
Right.
So basically, the town is dried up and blown away.
If you have a factory that's actually producing something of value that produces 5,000 people, you'll probably employ 15,000 to 20,000 people in the surrounding areas, either supplying goods or services to that factory.
I questioned some of my economics professors in college, and I said that if we are moving in the direction of a service economy, if we're basically here and we have no industry, won't we eventually get to the point where there is nothing left to service? I said if the law firm only exists to provide legal services to the accounting firm because there is no more automobile factory, and the accounting firm used to provide accounting services to the steel mill, but the steel mill's gone. Well, I guess they can provide accounting services to the law firm, and the law firm can provide legal services to them, but it's circular. They exist simply to service other service industries. And I said, on the international level, it will get to the point where, since all of our jobs are gone, we are now working at McDonald's. We can't afford to buy the stuff that the Chinese are producing and exporting to us. We'll be running perpetual deficits to the point where we simply can't sustain it, and then we won't be able to buy their crap. There'll
be
no more
exactly
market.
What's
for
going on? It's been going on.
I said that there would be no more market for their crap. Their factories would close, and that there would be a global economic depression, and it could be indefinite in length because there would be no easy way out of it.
Well, the whole idea of a service society is Jewish smoke and mirrors.
Well, you know what my professor told me when I raised all these concerns, that I was accused of being a communist.
Well, it's all Jewish subterfuge. There cannot be a service-based economy. A society that produces nothing of tangible value is a worthless society.
That's what I said. When they kept referring to us as a post-industrial economy, and I said that why don't you just call it what it is, a service economy or an economy with no future? And they didn't like that. They said that, you know, we should look forward to the day when we could all have great service jobs. One of them gave me a lecture on comparative advantage. He said that the Chinese can do it cheaper, so we should send them our jobs and let them do it cheaper, and we can do other things that we specialize in. So I said to him, hey, I'm sure we can get a guy in India, pay him $15,000 a year. We don't have to pay you $150,000 a year.
Well, that's our biggest problem. Why do we need things done cheaper? We don't need things done cheaper. More efficiently, maybe, but we don't need things done cheaper.
Exactly. And when I told him that we could replace him with an Indian professor for $15,000 a year and he could go home, he didn't like that. Suddenly, comparative advantage wasn't that great.
Well, why does the richest society what was once the richest society in the world always need things done cheaper? If you go to China to buy a toaster for $5 and you don't buy one off your brother that makes toasters for $6, you may as well take a knife and slice your brother's throat.
Absolutely. And isn't this the fatal flaw of Rome, of the West, of the British Empire, of the American South, of South Africa, of Rhodesia, the use of cheap non-white labor to get things cheap?
Well, it's always been our fatal flaw.
All right, continue along.
I mean, the Egyptians were bringing Nubians in as slaves, right?
Exactly, and look what happened to Egypt. Egypt's gone now.
Yes, it is.
In contradistinction to this, I shall try here to analyze Bolshevism into its basic elements and show these as clearly as I can to the German and European public. This is not an easy task, in view of the fact that the propagandist institutions of the Communist International are undoubtedly well organized and have not been unsuccessful in putting before the public of the world outside of the Russian frontiers an entirely false picture of Bolshevism. This picture is an extraordinarily dangerous one because of the tension which it can and must naturally cause. Let us also note the profound hatred in liberal circles throughout the world in regard to National Socialism and its practical constructive work in Germany. And this is just further proof, in my opinion, that National Socialism was not a socialist communist movement, or else the liberals would have drooled over it just as they did the Soviet Union. These liberals claim to favor progressivism and liberation of the workers, yet here in Germany, the workers were infinitely better off than in the Soviet Union, where the workers are basically now the equivalent of slaves under Stalin, yet the liberals become apologists for the Soviets, and they become enemies of the National Socialists.
But liberalism is only a disguise don't confuse what I say with the liberalism of Thomas Jefferson. That's a different liberalism.
Classical liberalism.
Right. That's not the liberalism I'm talking about. Modern liberalism is only a disguise for Bolshevism. It's the pretty and we're going to see that here in Goebbels' speech. Wait till we get to page 8. The pretty language of Satan deceiving the populace so that he could conquer it and take it over.
All right. Hence the possibility here also of mistaken judgments, such as these already mentioned. They pass by what is essential. International communism would entirely do away with all national and racial qualities which are founded in human nature itself. In property, it sees the most primary cause of the breakdown of world trade in the capitalist system. And just an aside here about the nature of race and nationality, we already see, we dealt with this in the Cultural Marxism series, that at this time, attacks were underway on the very foundation of Western thought in regards to the traditional attitudes towards race and towards personality and towards psychology. And Mr. Professor McDonald came on here and he dealt with that too, but you do remember that this is all basically happening at the same time, isn't it?
Of course. Yes, it is.
The whole Frankfurt School, Theodore Adorno, the invention of the idea of the authoritarian personality, which will ruin the world. This whole nature versus nurture argument. They would have us believe that we're all identical, that we all have the exact same potential, and that it's a matter of how much money the government spends, and that blacks are lagging so far behind because evil whitey is withholding the funds. And just as one more aside, I want to point out that the public school system where I went to school, 98% white, 97-98% graduation rate, one of the top districts in the state, spends $7,000 per student per year. Cleveland, about 40 miles down the road, 90% black probably, 50% graduation rate, they spend $22,000 per student per year. So obviously money's not the main issue, is it?
No, money's not the issue at all. The more we put into our school systems, the less we get out of them.
Absolutely.
When I was a kid, I went to I remember my high school algebra, my freshman year algebra class, had 80 kids in it. And we all learned. I can't remember anybody who failed that class. Well, we all got a grip on what algebra was about.
Accordingly, it exploits this through an extensive and carefully organized and brutal system of action, setting aside personal values and sacrificing the individual to a hollow mass idol that is only a travesty of actual life itself. At the same time, it ignores and destroys all the idealistic and higher strivings of men and nations through its own crass and empty materialistic principles. It sounds like he's perfectly describing modern American culture.
Well, it's a Bolshevik culture. I mean, we're a communist nation.
Absolutely.
There's no doubt.
America has no culture. I often ask myself, why do people exist? It seems that they simply exist to perpetuate their own existence. It's all circular. They don't serve any higher purpose. They have no higher calling. They exist for the beer that they're going to drink on Friday at the bar and the sexual hookup that they're hoping that will result from that trip to the bar.
That's it. It's materialistic, and society today, they want instant gratification, and everything's fast and cheap, and nothing's deep, and nothing is that there's no intellectualism, there's no culture left in this nation.
Well, they have no sense of obligation to state, family, community, God, anything.
Television has most of these young people today programmed where they can't concentrate on anything for more than 30 seconds. I've experienced that over and over again talking to young people.
If you
can't make your point in 30 seconds, you're not getting it through to them. It's over with.
I try to talk to people, and after about 2 minutes, they just tune out, if even
right.
that.
Right. It's the society raised on television and video games.
But I do have a few friends. I spoke with one of them for about 2 to 3 hours straight. And he thought the Jews were God's chosen people at the beginning of the conversation, but he thought it was odd because he thought that they're all communists, porn dealers, pawn shop owners, drug peddlers, and he thought it was odd that they could be God's chosen people, but the Bible says they are, so he was certain they were. Well, we had about a three-hour chat, and I just said, just let me talk here, and I'm probably going to offend you at some point in time. Just bear with me. And at the end of 3 hours, he was convinced they were the children of Satan. But not many people are willing to give that kind of time to anything, are they, unless it's a TV show?
Well, that's about it.
All right. On the other hand, National Socialism sees in all these things, in property, in personal values, and in nation and race, and the principles of idealism, these forces which carry on every human civilization and fundamentally determine its worth. And for reasons we just discussed, our society is basically worthless because we've turned our back on private property, personal values, obligation to nation and race. We have no more idealism. Americans don't exist for ideals anymore. They exist for base physical pleasures.
And these ideals that Goebbels spells out here, they're major threads within Mein Kampf that prove that Hitler was a devout Christian concerned for his kin, his nation, and his race. And that's what the Jews hate most, and that's why they hate Hitler.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I've quoted him often. I'm just going to reference it, not quote it. Douglas Reed said that his lengthy sojourns in America showed that Americans had lost their sense of purpose because none now existed. He said that our high-minded ideals of the 20s and 30s and before were gone, and that Americans really had no purpose, no meaning, they had no higher calling. This was his assessment in the 60s.
Sold out to Satan. We sold out to Satan in World War II by destroying our kinsmen. And we sold out to Satan in the 1950s with the age of the consumer. That's when it began.
All right. Bolshevism is explicitly determined on bringing about a revolution among all the nations. In its own essence, it has an aggressive and international tendency. But National Socialism confines itself to Germany and is not a product for export.
So they don't want to take over the world?
I guess Steven Spielberg was lying then.
I guess he must have been.
But National Socialism confines itself to Germany and is not a product for export either in its abstract or practical characteristics. In fact, when Fritz Kuhn, head of the American Nazi Party, went to Germany, I do not believe Hitler even met with him, did he?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
I think he had one of his minions meet with him. Bolshevism denies religion as a principle, fundamentally and entirely. It recognizes religion only as an opium for the people. For the help and support of religious belief, however, National Socialism absolutely places in the foreground of its program a belief in God and that transcendental idealism which has been destined by nature to bring to expression the racial soul of a nation.
So all those white nationalists that think that Hitler was some kind of pagan, or that Goebbels was a pagan, or that the National Socialist agenda was paganism, they're all a bunch of clowns fooling themselves. They're all a bunch of liars, and they're following after the Jews because that's what the Jews want you to believe. Goebbels was a Christian. Hitler
was a Christian. Hitler was a devout Christian who understood what Christianity was really about, the preservation of the Aryan race against the serpentine Jews.
Hitler scoffed at the idea of a return to German pagan values.
Absolutely. He scoffed at the pagans. He called them clowns. And he used the word clowns.
Yet somehow they think that if Hitler were here, he'd be shouting about Odin. If he were, it would only be in the context of telling them how stupid they were for seeking a return to those days and turning their back on God.
Absolutely. And here we see that Goebbels is definitely a Christian. And there are more statements than this from Goebbels, but this is...
They'll cite table talk, after-the-war nonsense, which the NKVD probably extracted out of, what was that, Dr. Albert Speer, right?
Well, I'm sure that Albert Speer probably didn't even write it. Some Jew probably wrote it for him.
Hmm. All right. National Socialism would give the lead in a new concept and shaping of European civilization, but the Bolsheviks carry on a campaign directed by the Jews with the international underworld against culture as such. Bolshevism is not merely anti-bourgeois, it is against human civilization itself. Wasn't it Paul who said that to be a Jew is to be contrary to all men?
You know, I have that quote right in front of me. It's 1 Thessalonians 2:14. Now Paul's talking to these Greeks. You have become imitators, brethren, of the assemblies of Yahweh in Judea, which are among the number of Christ Yahshua, because these same things even you have suffered by your own tribesmen, likewise they also by the Judeans, those who killed both Prince Yahshua Christ and the prophets and banished us and are not pleasing to Yahweh and are contrary to all men. That's what Paul did. That's how Paul described the Jews of his time.
What was it that Jewish author Maurice Samuels said in You Gentiles? Page 155, we Jews, we are the destroyers and will remain the destroyers. Nothing you can do will meet our demands and needs. We will forever destroy because we want a world of our own. To reiterate, nothing you can do will meet our demands and needs. I think that basically sums it up.
Well, any Christian who embraces the Jews should expect to be destroyed.
And
Christianity is a warning bell against the wiles of the Jews. We're told to avoid these people and not to have anything to do with them.
Jewish professor Dr. Kulischer, October 1937, notice the date, well before the war began and well before the alleged Holocaust. Quote, Germany is the enemy of Judaism and must be pursued with deadly hatred. The goal of Judaism of today is a merciless campaign against all German peoples and the complete destruction of the nation. We demand a complete blockade of trade, the importation of raw materials stopped, and retaliation towards every German woman and child, end quote. So it's okay for a Jew to get up there, call for the total destruction of an entire nation, but the Germans are expected not to fight back. So
We don't understand. What we don't understand, and we're going to see that here, is that Germany was the only nation in Europe that was making but Germany was the only nation in Europe that was making a stand against Bolshevism and the spread of Jewish communism that the Jews were actually concerned with. They really weren't concerned with Spain. I think they thought they were going to take Spain easily, They were surprised in Spain that they failed.
Hitler and Mussolini came in to help Franco. They weren't counting on Franco. He was a wild card. They didn't expect him. They didn't expect that the Spanish paratroopers and the Spanish Foreign Legion stationed in North Africa were actually going to do something. But, you know, Franco got together with all those generals, the patriots, and said, you know, the communists are taking over the country. Are we going to do something about it? And they said, absolutely. Hitler and Mussolini said, you know, we'll transport your soldiers from North Africa into Spain. They did, and then the war began.
In Talmudic Judaism, the Jews are their own Messiah. The Jews of the synagogues, after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, were being promised world hegemony through Bolshevism. World communism would bring the Jew world hegemony. Adolf Hitler stood in the way of that, and the Jews hated him because the Jews believed that Adolf Hitler was interfering with their arrival at their own messiahship, that the Pax Judaica, that the Jewish rule over the world, would not be attained if Germany stood in the way. And what we don't understand is that communism spread through Judaism, through the synagogues.
Mm-hmm.
And it still does today.
Well, the Dutch ambassador predicted all of this in 1918. He said that it was bound to spread in one form or another over Europe and the whole world because it was organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose one aim is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things, and that all the powers of the world would have to band together and destroy Bolshevism right there, strangled in the cradle, or it would dominate the world.
Right, and in truth, Judaism, I mean, the capitalists of England, the Rothschilds, funded Lenin.
So they knew Bolshevism was going to spread. They were counting on it spreading because they were spending money to help it spread.
Absolutely. Judaism is communism.
But they made a little foray.
Is Judaism.
They made a little foray into parts of Russia to make it look like they were aiding the white movement. I'd like to find out what they were really doing.
This is not about the Germans and the Jews. This is not about the Bolshevism and fascism.
No.
It's not about communism and democracy.
It's good versus evil.
It's about Jews versus Christians. It's about the serpent race in Genesis 3:15 versus the race of the woman in Genesis 3:15. It's about the children of the devil and the children of God. That's what this is about.
Wheat versus
all
tares.
All of the history for the last 2,000 years or the last 5,000 years has been right in context and in line with Genesis 3:15.
Absolutely. To repeat the last sentence, Bolshevism is not merely anti-bourgeois, it is against human civilization itself. In its final consequences, it signifies the destruction of all the commercial, social, political, and cultural achievements of Western Europe in favor of a deracinated and nomadic international cabal, which has found its representation in Judaism.
And which the Jewish capitalists of the West are a part of.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. This grandiose attempt to overthrow the civilized world is so much more dangerous in its effects because of the Communist International, which is a past master in the art of misrepresentation, has been able to find its protectors and pioneers among a great part of these intellectual circles in Europe, whose physical and spiritual destruction must be the first result of a Bolshevik world revolution. Bolshevism, which is in reality an attack on the world of the spirit, pretends to be intellectual itself. Where circumstances demand, it comes as a wolf in sheep's clothing. But
and
underneath,
that's as liberals. That's where the liberals come in. I'm sorry, go on.
Absolutely. A lot of them are just useful idiots. As Yuri Bezmenov pointed out, they're actually progressives. They see communism or the prospect of a communist revolution as a chance to advance their ideals to benefit and uplift the workers. And they're usually petty bourgeois, they're upper middle class, they're latte liberals. They have a very comfortable life, so they have time to sit around and do nothing other than ponder on socialism for 8 hours a day since they don't have to work. Yet when real socialists, real communists come to power, they're like Marie Spiridonova, that woman that was a Bolshevik idol for shooting a policeman in the face and killing him. They're spirited off to the gulags and never heard from again because they're offended that all the changes don't come about. When Lenin promises to liberate the workers and Marie Spiridonova sees that the only thing he's liberating from are their wages and their lives, she gets offended, speaks out, and then she becomes an enemy of the regime. Just like the Bolsheviks, they declared the Mensheviks and the left revolutionaries and the socialist revolutionaries to be enemies of the people, didn't they?
Well, it was rival Jewish gangs.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what it boils down to. They were all socialists. They were all communists.
Like the Sicilian Mafia versus the Albanian Mafia. They're basically all crypto Jews.
Absolutely. Or the Sicilian Mafia against the Sicilian Mafia. I mean, they were shooting each other in the streets of New York all the time.
Mm. All right. Where circumstances demand, it comes as a wolf in sheep's clothing. But underneath the false mask, which it here and there assumes, there are always the satanic forces of world destruction. So it seems Goebbels must have read Genesis 3:15.
Either that or he read Mein Kampf. I'm sure he read Mein Kampf because Hitler spells that out.
And where it has had the opportunity of practicing its theories, it has created, quote, the paradise of the workers and peasants, quote, in the shape of a fearful desert of starving and hungering people. If we are to take the word of its doctrine when we find a terrible contradiction between its theory and its practice, its theory is glowing and grandiose, but it carries poison in its attractive gloss.
Well, that's the lies that, that's the lies of the serpent to eat.
Surely thou shalt not die, thou shalt be as God.
A grandiose theory and not good in practice.
Over against this, what we have from it in reality is terrible and forbidding. This is shown in the millions of sacrifices which have been made in honor of it, through executions with the sword, the axe, or the hangman's rope, or hunger. Its teachings promise the fatherland of the workers and peasants, which shall know no frontiers, and a classless social order, which will be protected against exploitation through the state, and it preaches an economic principle in which everything belongs to everybody, and that thereby a real and universal world peace will be ushered in. Well, the idea that everything belongs to everybody, if you extend that to its natural conclusion, then parents have no right to raise their children because children belong to everybody. A husband has no right to sleep with his wife because she belongs to everybody. And we covered that in Russia number one. They tried to nationalize women. You wind up with a society that's in chaos.
Well, they've done that here just in a different way, from a totally different...
By pushing total promiscuity and the idea of sexual liberation, they've effectively nationalized women, haven't they?
Yes, they have.
Such that, you know, most guys are ready to hop into bed with anything that moves, and most women today are so cheap that they'll put out for any guy that asks.
No doubt.
So it's had the same end result.
It's the slow route to Bolshevism and the fast route to Bolshevism. It's the satanic destruction of the Christian world. And they've, in a pincer movement, that they've gotten us from both ends. There's no
Absolutely.
Doubt. And anybody that looks at the history of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s and doesn't understand that that's the total capitulation of the American people to the demands of Satan doesn't know anything about what Christian culture should be.
And I pointed out to my dad that all of the problems we're experiencing right now, they blame on capitalism, which in the minds of most Americans means free market, free enterprise, although true capitalism is a Jewish invention. But they're blaming all of the problems our economy is experiencing because of Jewish robber barons on the Anglo elite, the industrial giants, the Carnegie types, the Ford types. They're blaming all of our problems on free enterprise and private property and offering as the solution nationalization of key business, government-run health care systems, bureaucratic socialism. They're offering us as a cure for arsenic poisoning, strychnine, basically. You know, we're lying here wounded from ingesting arsenic, and they're offering us strychnine or cyanide. That's basically what it boils down to, since they run both sides.
Well, that's capitalism and Bolshevism. That's the two extremes we've been offered, right? And
mm-hmm.
and they're both entirely Jewish, and they're both entirely contrary to Christian culture.
Mm-hmm. In this teabag movement, this anti-Obamacare movement, what do they propose as an alternative? I believe, you know, from reading Mein Kampf, what I've read so far, as Hitler pointed out, that if all you do is oppose one person's worldview without offering your alternative, you're bound to fail. So these people that just say, hands off my health care, and they say no to Obamacare, if they don't offer an alternative view, an alternative opinion, they're going to fail. And I think they're basically set up to fail. This whole Patriot teabag movement, I think it's been set up to fail from the get-go.
Well, it's Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin. They're both working for the Jews. Palin is a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Beck may as well be a Jew. He's a racial sellout, and he's a sellout to even the mainstream conservatism.
He got fired from CNN, but Fox hired him. That's like, you know, Herschel fires you, but then Moshe hires you.
That's exactly what that is.
Glenn
Beck is a straight sellout.
They'll never put a true conservative up there. I mean, I won't get there. You won't get there. Eli's not going to get there.
They can't put a real conservative up there. They can't. They have to keep it. It's the Zionist world order. They have to keep it Zionist.
Mm-hmm. And I ask people, if you are a conservative, but you are not concerned about conserving your blood and conserving your race, then all you're really doing is conserving some changing ideological value. You're conserving some society so you can hand it over to another people. I don't want to maintain and preserve the infrastructure of this society so we can just hand it over to Mexicans in 20 years.
Most the teabaggers are going to do is elect us a Republican president in 2 years, and he's going to bring us 4 more years of neocons and Zionism.
Mm-hmm. If all we're going to do is limp along so in 40 years we can hand this country over to some Mugabe-style regime and we're gone, well, then the whole country might as well fall apart for all I care, since if we're not here, if we don't conserve the precious inheritance of our ancestors in the form of our blood, pure and unadulterated, then this country should just cease to exist.
Well, it may do that soon.
And that's basically, I think, what Theodore Bilbo, senator from Mississippi, said. He said that if our cities were destroyed in a great war, we could rebuild them out of the ashes of the old, even greater than before. That if our sons were killed in wars, we could rear new sons that would take the destiny of this nation in their hands and lead us into greatness. But he said, if the blood of our great white race should be mingled with the Negro race, we would be irretrievably and irrevocably lost and destroyed, and there would be no hope for America ever to recover, for nothing great could come from a mongrelized nightmare, as our nation would then become.
That's what we are.
And, you know, he won a U.S. Senate seat, and the Jews refused to seat him in the U.S. Senate. He had to fight for several months to actually get seated for the opening session of that year, despite the fact that he was popularly elected by the voters of Mississippi. The Jews would not seat him.
Well, that's like George Hader, right? He was democratically elected to be president of Austria, and they pressured Austria until he resigned.
Mm-hmm.
You could be democratically elected to anything as long as you agree with the Jews.
So people think we have a political solution. You know, just like Hamas, they win an election, and all of a sudden they're terrorists.
We have absolutely no political solution. Anybody who thinks that we could ever vote our way out of this oppression is a clown.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I figure if voting changed anything, the Jews would outlaw. Excuse me, they would outlaw it. They would do away with all pretense of elections, and we would have commissars on every street corner.
It's to be involved in the political process today. I mean, to use certain opportunities to awaken your brethren is one thing.
Yes.
But to be involved in the political process for the sake of the political process is absolutely futile.
And Hitler even pointed that out in Mein Kampf. He said that all the politicians, the conservatives, the right-wingers, the nationalists, as soon as they got elected, they stopped preaching to the masses. They didn't use parliament as a mechanism to reach the public. They simply became comfortable in their cushy jobs, and all they did was moderate their views and do it whatever they had to get reelected again and again, and they lost their revolutionary character that got them elected to begin with.
Well, the first blow that really corrupted our political system was the Supreme Court decision. I forget exactly what year it was made, but it was a long time ago, and it was it basically ruled that corporations were people that had the right to free speech.
Mm.
And Thomas Jefferson warned against that. He said, "Beware of permanent persons." And that's what a corporation is. It's a permanent person with the rights to free speech.
I don't think a corporation should be a person under the law.
Well, of course it shouldn't. But the Supreme Court made it a person and gave corporations a political voice. Supreme Court decision polluted our entire political system. That destroyed our political system.
1886, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad Company, most notable for the statement that corporations are entitled to protection under the 14th Amendment as persons under the law.
And that's absolutely evil. And that set up the perfect Jew world right there.
How can a corporation, an intangible entity, be a person under the law?
It can't be. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous that a corporation should have the same rights and freedoms that a man of the land does.
That seems like a Bolshevik decision.
It's absolutely it's a progressivist Bolshevik decision. There's no doubt.
All right. Continuing. Millions of workers on hunger wages, such as are not thought of in Western Europe. Millions of afflicted and sorrowing peasants who have been robbed of their land, which is being completely ruined by the stupid experiment of a paralyzing collectivism famine which claims millions of victims year after year in a country of such vast extent that it might serve as a granary for the whole of Europe. The formation and equipping of an army which, according to the claims of all leading Bolshevists, is to be used for carrying out the world revolution. The brutal and merciless domination of this madly led apparatus of state and party at the hands of a small terrorist minority, which is mostly Jewish. All this speaks another language, a language which the world cannot listen to permanently because it rings with the story of nameless suffering and indescribable hardships borne by a nation of 160 million people. And we covered in Russia number one and in the other material you brought in from the Third Rome that Russia was a granary of Europe. It was a massive industrial nation, and it basically it was outproducing most countries in the West, outproducing Germany, France, Britain, and the U.S. in some instances.
And
it
collecting lower taxes from its citizens.
Yes, it was a land of peace and plenty,
yes,
and the Jews
was.
Ruined it.
Yes, they did.
They would have us believe that the Tsar was some tinpot tyrant and a warmonger, yet the only war, I believe, that the Tsar got them in, he didn't even start. It was the Russo-Japanese War, which began with the Japanese launching a surprise attack against Port Arthur and, I believe, against Vladivostok, where the Russian Pacific Fleet was based. And, you know, the Tsar didn't expect a surprise attack since he thought Japan...
Well, that was a Rothschild-engineered war.
Exactly. I believe, who was it that funded them? Jacob Schiff of Kuhn, Loeb & Company helped finance Japan in the 1880s and 1890s to industrialize them and build them up. British naval officers went to Japan and trained Japanese. They built ships in British shipyards. The hands of British workers built these ships that were later used to sink Russian ships. They sank the entire Russian Pacific Fleet. Then they sank the entire Russian Atlantic and Baltic Fleet. And I remember reading in Stoddard's The Rising Tide of Color, he says that even Germans, French, Italians, and Brits who were observing the Russian prisoners being taken away in the captivity in Japan, even the Germans, a traditional enemy of Russia, said that they were greatly saddened by it because they were seeing their white cousins taken away by foreign Asiatic yellow men. And that was basically the remark of one of the German ambassadors who was there. He said he was greatly saddened to see his white cousins in Russia defeated at the hands of the Oriental. And that kind of racial solidarity just doesn't exist anymore, does it?
No, it doesn't.
All right. The fact that, in order to carry out its aims, Bolshevism uses propagandist methods which are perceptible only by those which have experience in such things and are entirely accepted in good faith by the average citizen makes this terror international extraordinarily dangerous for other states and peoples. This propaganda starts out from the principle that the end sanctifies the means, that lies and slander, the terrorizing of the individual and of the mass, robbery and burnings and strikes and insurrection, espionage and sabotage of armies can and ought to be made use of, and therewith that the aim of revolutionizing the whole world must be specially and solely kept in view. This extraordinarily pernicious method of influencing the masses of the people does not stop before anything or anybody. Those alone are competent to deal with it, who see into its secret driving forces and are capable of adopting the necessary contrary measures. This propaganda understands how to adopt every instrument to its purpose. It takes on an intellectual shape in intellectual circles. It is bourgeois with the bourgeoisie and proletarian with the proletariat. It is mild and passive where the attitude suits, and it is pugnacious wherever it meets opposition that needs to be suppressed. And haven't we seen this? Bush was a man of the people when he was speaking to the workers, yet when he was speaking to the elite, he referred to them as, some call you the elite, I call you my base.
Well, we've seen this throughout American history, where the elite academics can be communists, and it was fashionable, and where the unionized workers can be communists, and thought that they were going to take advantage of their employers through communism or through communist principles, and that's what American unions today are basically just an extension of Bolshevism.
All right. Would you like to take over for the next few pages?
If you remember back in Russia number one, where workers' panels made every decision that goes on in a factory.
The Committee of the Poor.
Well, right. And that's all implemented here in the American union system since the 1950s, 60s?
No work gets done if the union says no work gets done. My father was forced to strike several times when he worked at a company he used to work at. I won't name it because I don't want to give any identifying information away. But he was not an active member of the union since he said that I do not want to join the union. I will not join the union. I'm a professional laborer. I should not be required to join a union. Furthermore, I'm an individual and I should be given the freedom to decide if I want to join. And he said, I do not wish to affiliate with this association. And they said to him that if you're going to work here, you have to belong to the union. So he didn't go to any of the meetings. He said to them, I want it clear that I don't believe you represent me, but they still claim to represent him. And they took union dues out of his paycheck automatically, despite the fact that he said he did not want to join.
Right. And a lot of states, I remember in New Jersey, you didn't have to join a union, but they would take, I forget what the percentage is. It may have been 50% or 70% of the dues of a regular member anyway.
Mm-hmm. And what did they do for him? Every few years, they would force him to use 4 or 5 vacation days when they would decide to go on strike to make a point. And occasionally, they got him a nickel an hour raise.
Well, the unions are basically communist organizations run by crime rings. That's the way I see them, and they're
just the way.
No, I'm not. I am not defending General Motors and Ford and the steel mills, but or the capitalists at random, but the unions basically made it almost impossible for those corporations to be profitable.
And for the record, I believe there was a time when abuses in business and big business were so extreme that the workers had to band together to fight the total power hold that the management had a monopoly. But that time is well over.
There's no doubt, but that time is long past. That's absolutely correct. And in the 1800s, there was probably a need for unions.
The Gilded Age.
There's no doubt. But today, in the 1970s, when an assembly line worker at GM gets half the year off and gets paid $50 an hour to turn the same bolt 300 times a day, that's just ridiculous.
They killed the goose that laid the golden egg.
And where the unions really hurt with these fantastic demands that certain companies employ certain amounts of employees in certain plants, and if they didn't have 30,000 employees at this plant, we were all going to quit working. That's absolutely ridiculous.
And these union leaders, they do nothing. They say nothing about the mass migration of Mexicans here illegally. They say nothing about the exportation of jobs. It seems all we do, we import foreign workers to compete with the people already here, and we export jobs. The union leaders are strangely silent on those issues, aren't they?
Well, the unions are like the Catholic Church. They want to grow their power base. That's all they really want to do. And they welcome with open arms all of these lowlifes coming across the border.
Who will undercut their own members and take their members' jobs.
And do it for less. And they see future union members is what they see.
They see a
growing proletariat is what they see.
Stoddard and Grant both wrote, Stoddard more so, that the white man could not compete with the Oriental because we actually have decent expectations for our living situation, that the white man wants to have land, he needs land to expand and to be comfortable on, to have children, and that the Chinaman will live in a loft above his store or sleep under his counter, and they'll have 30 in one house, and they'll have bunk beds in the hallways. And I have seen this in my experience. Stoddard said that they would work on one bowl of rice a day for 10 or 12 hours at least. Some would work into the night, and that no white man can compete with such conditions or should be expected to compete. He said that it's not that they outperform us, it's that they lower their standard of living to the level of animals, and white people won't do that. And I'd like to point out, too, that that's what I believe. It's not that Mexicans do work we won't do. It's that they accept living conditions which we find intolerable.
Well, I've seen that over and over again with my own eyes. I mean, I've seen 20, 30 Chinese people living in the same two-family house. I've seen Pakistanis with 8, 10, 12 people living in a 2-3-room apartment.
Mm-hmm. They busted a house over here. There were at least 30 Chinamen living in it, 3 bedrooms. They had triple bunk beds in the hallways, and they had 6 people in each bedroom.
And that's how they live. And they have their overhead to live is zero.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows them to buy our businesses.
Well, they have 30 people living in one household, and they're only paying one mortgage on it, or they saved up and they paid cash for it. And while they're all living there, 28 of them are out working, one maintains the house, and one does whatever. They get 28 checks. We can't compete with that.
Hell no, we can't compete with that. And they don't mind living like that one bit, because it's still a hell of a lot better than they were living back in China.
Mm-hmm. The same thing with the Mexicans. And I think what tipped the authorities off to those 30 Chinamen, neighbors reported a great stench frequently coming from the property.
Well, they're filthy people. I know that firsthand.
Exactly.
I mean, I lived in close quarters with them long enough.
All right.
And yes, there are plenty of Chinese people in American prisons, too. Most of them on credit card fraud. That's their biggest game is credit card fraud and identity theft. They're real big into that.
Would you like to take over for the next few pages?
Bolshevism carries on its international propaganda through the Comintern. A few weeks ago, this apparatus for world destruction made public to the whole of Europe its plan of campaign for the annihilation of the nations and the states, all arranged and set forth in its tactical and strategic elements. Yet the bourgeois world, whose extirpation was announced openly and without any reserve whatsoever, failed to make any public protest of indignation and unite all the forces at its command as a definite counter-defense. The cry of warning was raised only by those states in which Bolshevism has finally overcome through the restoration, been overcome through the restoration of national principles. But this cry of warning was laughed at by the threatened bourgeois world and set aside as an exaggerated alarm. Swept clear of internal enemies and united under the National Socialist standard, Germany placed herself at the head of the groups marshaled in the fight against the international Bolshevization of the world. And here I believe that Goebbels is spelling out what I've been saying for the past few months, that this is a war between Judaism and Christianity.
That's why Jews declared war on Germany.
Exactly. This is a war between Satan and the children of God. It's a war between the Jews and the Christian nations. And Goebbels is basically verifying that.
And that's
why
March 24, 1933, Judea declared war on Germany in the headline of the British Daily Express.
Yes, and I have one of those newspapers. It's not the Daily Express. It's the let me look. Let me find
I have
out.
Looked. I have looked into obtaining an issue. The British Daily Express never returned my email, and they do not make that issue available. You can go on their website.
You go on their website.
They have a little thing about archives of old issues. Request an old issue, and I go to March 22nd. That's available. March 23rd, that's available. March 24, 1933, not available, no preview available. But they have a preview available and an issue available for March 25th and March 23rd, but not March 24th.
Well, I have a copy of that Daily Express facsimile is on the front page of the Mein Kampf Project at Christigenia. And I'll have one of the gentlemen here, Obadiah, has possibly achieved a much better copy that he's going to send me.
Well, the thing is, I wanted a complete, actual March 24, 1933 newspaper, one for my collection, just kind of, you know, I really want one. I think it'd be neat to have. And two, lately the Jews have taken the saying that that paper doesn't exist, that the Daily Express didn't print a paper that day, and that the front page image circulating on Google, which shows Judea declares war on Germany, is a neo-Nazi hoax. It's a fabrication that somebody paint-shopped, basically. That's what they're starting to say.
Well, that's a straight lie, and there's many other sources that corroborate the fact that Judea declared war on Germany in 1930.
Absolutely. And the fact is that within about 2 weeks of that issue declaring war on Germany, 20-plus thousand Jews protested against Germany in New York, and tens of thousands of Jews organized protests in Australia, Britain, Palestine, South Africa, France, Canada. There were coordinated protests all across the world. I guess that was just great timing, wasn't it?
There are no coincidences like that, let me tell you. It's absolutely incredible that the Jews would try to hide something that was so prominent.
So Wesley Swift spoke about Judea declares war on Germany in the 50s. I guess he must have had a real early version of Paint Shop Pro.
I guess so. I also have on the front page of Christian, there's a link to a Time magazine page that Municher put there and on my Mein Kampf project. And this is a Life magazine page. It's page 11 from the October 31st, 1938 issue of Life magazine. America gets ready to fight Germany, Italy, and Japan. October 31st, 1938. Now, that's about a year before the Germans invaded Poland.
That's absolutely blatant.
That's a crime.
I guess Wesley Swift used the same time machine to gain access to Paint Shop Pro that Anne Frank used to get a ballpoint pen.
I guess she did. How could this be that the Jews announced this in 1938 in Life magazine?
Well, we went over in history class, in AP US and AP European history class, the US was in an undeclared naval war with Germany as early as 1940, and we even, you know, we talked about the incident with the Reuben James, how a German U-boat sank the destroyer after it was attacking a U-boat convoy.
Well, right, but this actually is 2 years before that.
But most people have no idea that Rosenfeld ordered American destroyers to sink German U-boats on sight as early as 2 years before we got into World War II. He said that he would do everything to keep us out of the war, yet he did everything he could to get us into the war.
Yes, he did. And Woodrow Wilson did the same thing with World War I. He ran an anti-war campaign and promised not to send us into the war. And as soon as he got elected, he sent us into the war. It's incredible, but it's
well,
there's no mechanism in this country for holding politicians to broken campaign promises.
I mean, that's fraud.
The next election, so you basically, it is fraud. And,
so if I sell you a house and I claim that the foundation is great, you move in, and 3 weeks later it collapses from a crappy foundation, you're going to get me on fraud, and you're going to win.
If the party in power, if the party in power doesn't want to impeach, that there's no way that it's going to be done. There's
absolutely
going to be repercussions.
And there really is no such thing as genuine opposition.
No, it's all orchestrated by the media and the Jews that make our money.
The whole impeach Bush movement, that was never going to go anywhere. The Democrats weren't going to impeach him. They love him.
Of course they did. And Obama has kept all his policies, all his policies in Afghanistan and Iraq. One of his policies has been changed.
Several local district attorneys, though, have indicted Bush for murder under the theory that since the Iraq war is illegal, Bush is personally responsible under the command responsibility doctrine for every American soldier that died in Iraq. And as far as I'm concerned, that's valid logic. Since Congress never declared war, it was an illegal military incursion. He's responsible for the deaths of everybody. And Obama's
nearly all of our wars since World War II have been illegal from that viewpoint. Swept clear of internal enemies and united under the National Socialist standard, Germany placed herself at the head of the groups marshaled in the fight against the international Bolshevization of the world. So it's Germany against the Jews, because people have to know that the Jews are Bolshevism.
Yet,
herein,
Rosenfeld said, we have to become the great arsenal of democracy, and that means giving weapons to the Soviet Union.
Well, right. Democracy is just a key word for Jewish capitalism. That's all it is. It's a code word for Jewish capitalism.
And most idiot Americans think we're a democracy. We're a constitutional republic.
We've never intended to be a democracy. Herein, she is quite aware that she is fulfilling, she meaning Germany, a world mission which reaches out beyond all national frontiers. On the successful issue of this mission depends the fate of our civilized nations. There's your Dutch ambassador. As nationalist socialists, we have seen Bolshevism through and through. We recognize it beneath all its masks and camouflages, like liberalism. It stands before us, derobed of its trappings, bare and naked in its whole miserable imposture. We know what its teachings are. Too bad Americans don't. But we also know what it is in practice. Here I shall give an unvarnished picture, which is backed up in all particulars by incontestable facts.
If there is a spark of reason left in the world and the faculty for clear thinking, then the states and peoples must be shocked at the prospect and induced to come together for their common defense against this acute danger. I leave the methods and practices of the communist propaganda and theory within and without Russia to speak through examples which appear to me to be symptomatic. These examples could be replaced and supplemented by thousands of others, all of which, when taken together, show up the terrible aspect of this world disease. Murder of individuals, murder of hostages, and mass murder are the favorite means applied by Bolshevism to get rid of all opposition to its propaganda.
And we covered in Russia number one, in their own publications in Russia, the communists published again and again how many people they killed, sometimes the names of who they killed, the dates that they killed them. Sometimes they published warnings that they were going to hold massacres. So they were very open and brazen about it, yet we're to believe that the Germans killed all these Jews and they kept it quiet.
Yeah, it was a big secret. It was never spoken. The orders that were never spoken. Incredible.
And I believe David Irving has a $10,000 Hitler challenge that if anyone can prove that Hitler ordered murder of the Jews, he will pay them $10,000. Thus far, no one has ever collected it because no one can produce a document with his signature on it saying, hey, Himmler, start gassing the kikes. No one can show that.
I don't think David will be paying that money. In Germany, 300 National Socialists fell victims to the communist terror practiced on individuals. You know, this is a game with the Jews that's thousands of years old. The apostles were in fear of the Jews. They didn't want to walk in Judea.
Well, they killed George Lincoln Rockwell here in this country.
They killed John the Baptist. They killed
Charles Lindbergh's baby to silence
him.
Yes, they did.
That's what the Jews do.
Eli and I covered that yesterday, that in Matthew 14, they killed John the Baptist because he was a revolutionary and they couldn't stand that. They couldn't have him preaching.
They killed John the Baptist because they were offended by what he was preaching. He was preaching the law.
He was a preacher of the truth.
Yes, he was.
And he knew that Herod was a usurper, didn't he?
And for that reason, they killed Christ. And for that reason, they wanted to kill Paul. And for that reason, they killed James. They killed both Jameses.
And they want to kill all who come in Christ's name.
Yes, they do. Everybody that stands up to their world dominion, that their theft of the world, because they don't make anything. I don't know a Jew that's ever made anything. I can't name one.
Well, in one of my business classes, we went over a documentary, and in the documentary, it was a Tupperware plastics company, and they said that they have a major problem with intellectual property theft involving Israel and that they can't get the Israeli courts to domesticate any judgments against the companies, that they get in an international court or in a U.S. court. So it seems that the Jews don't produce anything, they steal.
Didn't Hitler say that Israel was being set up to be a haven for Jewish thieves?
In a high school for more thieves.
That's exactly what he told us about 30 years before it happened.
Everybody in the business world that I've ever spoken with, if they've ever had any dealings with Israel, they say that the Israelis engage in corporate espionage on an industrial mass level. It's insane what the Israelis do. They say that anything that they have, specifications, the Israelis want to steal it, and then they're going to turn around and either give it to China or sell it to China. And then they're going to start producing their own copy of it, too. The Israelis never innovate or create anything particularly wonderful. They simply steal something that we do, they tweak it, and they get credit for it. Like the Galil, the Uzi, those aren't original Israeli weapons.
The Uzi was a Slavic weapon, wasn't it?
The Uzi was a ripoff from a Czechoslovakian submachine gun that was made in the 20s and 30s.
Okay.
It was pretty innovative at the time. It was the first submachine gun with an overhung bolt design, enabling the overall size of the weapon to be much smaller, more compact, and it had a magazine that fed into the hand grip. So it was very innovative. And the Israelis basically just stole that, tweaked it a bit, made it slightly different. They called it the Uzi, and now they're famous for it. And people think, wow, those Israelis, they're so creative. They make great weapons.
Well, they've moved a lot of software companies over there, and a lot of specialized computer hardware companies are over there, and they've also a lot of biotech, biogenetic, you know, these biotech companies, they've moved a lot of them over there.
And who knows what they're doing.
The two biggest companies that create the software for routers, that police the internet are both in Tel Aviv. They're both in Israel.
How convenient. And my dad told me that when he used to work for a company about 20 years ago, they acquired an Israeli firm. They bought them out. And the Israelis at that firm that were acquired, they would demand that the meetings be held at Tel Aviv local time, these teleconferences, and they acted like they were the ones that had done the acquiring. He said that they were the most arrogant people that he'd ever had to deal with or that anybody in his company had ever had to deal with. They found the Israelis to be absolutely disagreeable and everything and basically utterly worthless. He said that they didn't really do any honest work at all, and all they did was they demanded that their demands be met. They insisted that you better listen to us or else. Or else what? You've been bought out by us. We own you. But they acted like they were the ones who were in charge.
Well, that's the way they are. There's no doubt. That's their pattern. It's their world. They're the princes of this world, the children of Satan. That's what the New Testament teaches us. That's what the whole biblical story is. And they can do whatever they want as long as there are 50 million Christians out there worshiping them. Because that's what Judeo-Christianity is all about. Judeo-Christianity is the Christian worship of the Jew. That's exactly what they all do. The Jews are their own Messiah, and the Christians are worshiping them. It's incredible. Okay, we should probably wrap this up until next week. It's what are your thoughts on that?
Well, if you have any closing thoughts, or if you'd like to wrap it up in some fashion, I think
I'm good to go. I don't want to get started on a it's a fairly new section we're getting into, and it's probably best to cover it all at once.
All right, we've covered quite a bit for now, so next week we will continue on. Yahweh bless.
Praise Yahweh. Thank you.